There is an episode of Sesame Street where Grover is taking a tour of the Museum of Everything. He is so excited to see and to learn all these new things. But then, when he gets to the end of the tour, he grows despondent because now there's nothing left to discover. Just then, he sees a doorway with a sign over it that says, "The Museum of Everything Else." His heart leaps for joy as he makes his way through that doorway, ready to make yet further new discoveries. Spiritual life should be like that. Continuous discovery, open to new things. Have you ever met somebody who's been in church so long, they've gotten a little bit crusty? They think they've learned everything that there is to learn about God and about the Scriptures. They can tell you the correct doctrine about God on any subject. They can tell you the correct interpretation of every Bible passage. They are dwelling in the Museum of Everything. How boring. How sad. And how delusional. Because if God is infinite and we are finite, then by definition, no matter how much we learn about God and the Scriptures, we can never plumb their full depths. Because if an infinite God inspired the Holy Bible, then the Bible itself is filled with lesson after lesson after lesson, a lifetime of learning. Today, we're going to focus on a gospel passage that, frankly, is probably my all-time least favorite gospel passage, because the way Jesus behaves in this passage makes me uncomfortable. I'm going to share with you the traditional interpretation of this passage that is enshrined in the Museum of Everything. Every time in my life I've heard this passage preached on in churches of my past, it's always been the same interpretation, and it might be right. But then I'm also going to invite you to follow me into the Museum of Everything Else as we explore an alternative interpretation. And when you hear the two different interpretations, you can then decide for yourself which interpretation resonates with you. Because here at Life Journey Church, we don't all have to agree on everything. Imagine a church where we don't all have to think alike. Because where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. The alternative interpretation that I'm going to share with you today comes from Helen Brooke Pearson's book entitled "Do What You Have the Power to Do: Studies of Six New Testament Women." This book is the basis for our current sermon series. Let's say a prayer, and then we'll dive in to the deep end. God, give us open hearts and minds, coupled with careful, thoughtful, Spirit-led discernment. Because we want to understand what you want to say to us through today's gospel passage, so that we can become more like Jesus, in whose name we pray. Amen. At the outset of Jesus' public ministry, he articulated for himself and for his disciples who were partnering with him in ministry, he articulated his vision of the scope of his messianic mission. He put it to the disciples as he instructed them this way, Matthew 10:5. He said to them, "Go nowhere among the Gentiles and enter no town of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. As you go, proclaim the good news that the kingdom of heaven has come near." So as Jesus launched his public ministry, his sense of calling to his messianic mission had him focused on the lost sheep of the house of Israel. His mission was to save Israel so Israel in turn could be a light to the world. But by the time we reach the end of Jesus' earthly ministry, and right before he ascends into heaven, he again articulates his vision of the scope of his mission, but this time in an exponentially greater way. Jesus says to his disciples, "Go therefore and make disciples, not just in Israel, but of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit." All of which causes me to wonder, what happened between the start of Jesus' ministry on earth and the end of it? What happened that changed his mind, that exponentially expanded his sense of his messianic call from focusing just on his own people to this encompassing, inclusive vision that he was here for everybody? Today's gospel passage, which occurs somewhere in the middle of Jesus' ministry, appears to be a pivotal point in that process of the globalization of Jesus' messianic mission. You heard Amy share the story a little bit earlier. It begins by telling us, Matthew 15:21, that Jesus went away from the district of Tyre to the district of Tyre and Sidon. In other words, he left Israel proper, crossed the border, and entered a foreign territory, probably to get a little R&R, a little rest. He and his disciples had been ministering intensely, and their ministry to the Israelites, they were surrounded by Israelites all the time. So this was a way of getting away from all of that so that they could take a breather and renew their spirits. But while Jesus is in this foreign territory, we're told that a Gentile woman, of a foreigner, accosted Jesus. Matthew 15:22, a Canaanite woman from that region, that foreign region, came out and started shouting at Jesus, "Have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David. My daughter is tormented by a demon." And she keeps shouting and trying to get Jesus' attention. And when Jesus hears her, he stops. He turns to her and he says, "Show me where your daughter is, and I will heal her." Right? No. That's not what Jesus does. Instead, the text tells us he did not answer her at all. That's not what we would expect of Jesus. Right? In every other gospel story where somebody needs healing, Jesus is there. Jesus wants to help. But here this woman is calling out to him, and he acts like she's not even there. But she is absolutely determined not to take no for an answer. She keeps shouting until the disciples, fed up with it all, they say, "Jesus, send her away." She keeps shouting after us. In other words, they say, "Jesus, just do something, say something to make this stop. We can't stand." And that's when Jesus turns to the woman and says to her, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." There you see it again, this initial conception of the scope of his ministry as being focused on saving his people, the people of Israel. Yet still, she persisted. Remember when Senator Mitch McConnell said that about Senator Elizabeth Warren, and then women started wearing that phrase emblazoned on their t-shirts? Still, she persisted. This woman will stop at nothing to get a miracle of healing for her daughter. And so, instead of going away, she kneels before Jesus, she looks him in the eye, and she says to him, Lord, help me. She apparently had heard enough about Jesus through the grapevine that she knew he was a great healer. And she knew that he was reported to have a heart of compassion. And she's heard what he said. You're beyond the scope of my ministry. Sorry. I mean, you got to set boundaries somewhere, right? You've heard the phrase, if you try to be everything to everybody, you might end up being nothing to nobody. So Jesus seems to have felt called to focus. But now here's this woman saying, Lord, help me. And Jesus utters these edgy words. It's not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs. Whoa. Jesus, that's just a little bit insensitive, don't you think? Are you saying that people like this woman, Gentiles, are dogs? But the woman is undeterred, undaunted. She comes back at Jesus with a thoughtful and witty reply. She says to him, yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table. In other words, Jesus, I have so much faith in what you can do. All I'm asking for is a crumb, and my daughter will be healed. And Jesus is blown away by that. And the text tells us, he said to her, woman, great is your faith. Let it be done for you as you wish. And her daughter was healed instantly. Okay? That's the gospel story. Now the question becomes, what should we make of it? What's happening in this story? And more importantly, what are we supposed to learn from this gospel story? The traditional interpretation of this story says that the point that this gospel story is trying to drive home is the critical importance of relentlessly persistent faith to accomplishing great things in this world. This woman demonstrates in this passage what a relentless, persistent faith looks like and how it can change things that seem to be impossible. And so the theory of this interpretation, the way this interpretation of the story sees the story unfolding, when the woman is shouting at Jesus and he's not responding, it's not that he doesn't want to help her. It's that he's testing her faith to see if her faith is great enough to receive the miracle that she's seeking. In other words, it sees Jesus when he's, quote, ignoring this woman as pretending to be indifferent, as play acting, if you will, to test her faith. And when the woman persists, Jesus tests her even further by making that edgy comment about it wouldn't be right to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs. He's still testing her. And she's passing this test with flying colors because she still won't take no for an answer. She comes back with that witty response and says, all I need is a crumb from your table. And Jesus is blown away by her faith and grants her the miracle that she seeks. That is the traditional interpretation of this gospel passage that I've heard preached every time I've heard this passage preached on in the churches of my past. And I accept the fact that a key lesson we can learn from this passage is the importance of persistent, relentless faith. I get that. But this interpretation of the story has always left me feeling like there's something missing here. It doesn't completely meet the facts of the story and the way Jesus is described as behaving in this story. And I find myself thinking, are we missing something here? What are we missing? What could convincingly explain to me Jesus' behavior? Because in all the other miracle stories in the Gospels, Jesus doesn't put people through the ringer to get their miracle. He's very responsive to them. What's going on here? It's at this point that I want to share with you an alternative interpretation, a different way of seeing this story. Two men were walking alongside the Ohio River, one on one side, one on the other. A Hoosier walking along the Indiana side of the river, a Kentuckian walking along the Kentucky side of the river. As they're walking along, at one point, the Hoosier calls across the river to the Kentuckian and says, "How do I get to the other side of the river?" The Kentuckian calls back and says, "You are on the other side of the river." I guess he had a point, right? So much of how we see any given situation depends on our vantage point. Is there another vantage point from which to view our gospel story that will seem to explain all the facts of this story? Pearson offers us an alternative interpretation, and I should warn you, this interpretation is going to challenge and stretch us to think in ways we may never have before. Sorry, my earpiece keeps falling off. In ways we never have before. So I guess I should ask your permission. Maybe I should take a vote. All right? How many of you say, "Jeff, I am contented to live in the museum of everything. I don't want to hear the alternative interpretation. I think I already know what it means, and I don't want you messing with my heart and my mind today. Besides, if I vote no, that means your sermon will be over. I'll get to go to brunch and get an early start on the holiday weekend." How many vote no? I am taking names, by the way. All right, how many say, "It's a little bit scary, but I'm willing to walk with you into the museum of everything else and allow myself to explore this alternative interpretation. I'm game for it." Raise your hand. All right, you are the congregation that I thought you were. And I suppose I also should ask, do you promise that if you disagree with this alternative interpretation, you will not get angry and leave the church? All right, we're cleared for takeoff. First, a little bit of background information that you'll need to understand to delve in to Pearson's interpretation. In classic Christian theology, as reflected in the Apostles' Creed and the Nicene Creed and in the New Testament scriptures, we're taught that Jesus, before he was born here on earth, existed already as the Son of God in heaven. It's referred to as the pre-existence of Jesus. As the Son of God in heaven, before he was born here on earth, Jesus was deity. In other words, Jesus shared in all the divine prerogatives with God the Father and God the Spirit. That means Jesus had infinite knowledge. That means Jesus had infinite power. But there came a time when Jesus, with such a heart of compassion and seeing the mess we humans were making of everything down here on earth, there came a time when Jesus volunteered to be born a human, to come to us so as to live among us and show us the way and save us. And so Jesus was born as a human. While he was here on earth, classic theologians tell us, Jesus was both divine and human. Son of God, Son of man. While here on earth, theologians tell us, the phrase they use is Jesus was fully human, fully divine. I believe that. I've heard that preached many times in the churches of my past. But never once did I ever hear a thoughtful conversation of what that meant for Jesus when he was here on earth. Operationally, what did that feel like for Jesus? What did that mean? What did the interface between Jesus' humanity and his divinity look like? There are two different paradigm options, probably more than two, but two different paradigm options for understanding what it means to say that Jesus here on earth was both human and divine. Let me put it this way. Picture Jesus when he was an infant of 3 months old, lying in a crib, babbling like three-month-old babies will do, maybe drooling a little bit. As Jesus lay there in that crib, all the while, as he was babbling and cooing, secretly in his mind was he working calculus equations and holding the cosmos together. Secretly there in the crib, did he still possess the power to levitate his favorite toy and cause it to drop into his crib? You see what I'm asking? What I'm asking is, when Jesus was born as a human, was his humanity just a shell, a cloak, a disguise, if you will, and I don't mean that in a negative way, that was housing an inner being that still had infinite knowledge and infinite power? Is that what it means to say that Jesus was both human and divine? That's certainly one option, and I think by default, without ever really thinking about it, that's how most of us think about Jesus, that while here on earth, knew everything, had all power. But there is another paradigm for understanding the interface between Jesus' divinity and humanity, and that would look like this, that when Jesus came to earth and was born as a human, he voluntarily relinquished his divine prerogatives. That he temporarily, I'm not saying that he wasn't the Son of God here on earth, he was. But I'm saying that what if he voluntarily relinquished his divine prerogatives, infinite knowledge, infinite power, while he was here on earth so as to become authentically human, so as to be authentically one of us living among us, so as to be able to authentically show us the way, the truth, and the life. So that when Jesus said, follow me, we wouldn't say, easy for you to say, Jesus, you're cheating. You've got infinite knowledge and infinite power. How could you expect us to follow you when we don't have access to those same powers? What if Jesus voluntarily surrendered those powers temporarily in order to be authentically one of us so as to show us the way? Actually, the New Testament seems to teach that second paradigm. Look at what Philippians 2:6 says. Though Jesus was in the form of God in the heavens before he was born here on earth, he did not regard equality with God as something to be exploited, as something to be clung to. Instead, when he was born as a human, he emptied himself, being born in human likeness. Note that phrase. He emptied himself. He emptied himself of what? Of the prerogatives that came with being equal to God. So that Jesus came to us as authentically human. Jesus himself tells us that while he was here on the face of the earth, he didn't know everything. His knowledge was not infinite. He tells us that when he's talking about the end times. In Matthew's gospel, look what he said. He said about that day and hour, the end of the world, the timing of the end of the world. He said about that day and that hour, no one knows. Neither the angels in heaven nor the Son. That's Jesus. But only the Father. So Jesus didn't know when the world was going to end. I'm sure he did when he was in heaven and when he returned to heaven. But here among us, like us, he had to wonder, when will the end come? So, put that together, and if we embrace that second paradigm, and we don't all have to think alike, but if we embrace that second paradigm, that means that as a three-month-old lying in that crib, Jesus was a tabula rasa, a blank tablet, like any three-month-old would be. And he had to go through the authentically human process of growing and learning. Jesus, like all of us, at some point on his journey, had to remember reawaken, if you will, to his identity as the Son of God. Just like all of us at some point on our journey have to remember and reawaken to our status as children of God. Now, Jesus was Son of God in a much more intense way than we are children of God, but you understand what I'm saying. If Jesus was authentically human, that means somewhere along the way in his life's journey, Jesus had to learn how to harness the power of God through faith and the power of the Holy Spirit within him. So that, just like all of us, Jesus wasn't working his amazing miracles with divine power. He was working his amazing miracles with faith in the divine power of the Spirit within him. That's why Jesus could look us in the eye in the Gospel of John and say, the same things I have done, you will do. In fact, you will do even greater things. Because Jesus wasn't cheating. He wasn't using his divine power to work these miracles. He was using his faith in God to work these miracles because his power, divine power, had been temporarily suspended here on earth. What this also means is that just like all of us, Jesus, along his journey of life, had to remember and awaken to the fullness of his calling, of who God wanted him to be. And like us, sometimes over time, God expands our awareness of the scope of our calling. He had to awaken to the fullness of the messianic calling that was on his life. Putting all of that together, Pearson now looks at today's gospel story and says, aha, I see what's going on in this story. God called this Gentile woman to challenge Jesus' sense of mission as being focused on saving his own people, to challenge him to exponentially grow that into a far more encompassing and inclusive vision. So in Pearson's interpretation of this story, as the woman is shouting at Jesus and he is responding with utter silence, in this way of seeing the story, it's not that Jesus didn't want to heal her. It's not that Jesus was somehow pretending to test her faith. Rather, it's that Jesus was himself trying to figure out what to do in this situation. Jesus himself was internally torn between his deep desire to help this woman's daughter and his deep desire to stay within the scope of his God-given mission. And so he was wrestling with, if I step outside my focus on my own people, and now I have to minister to all the Gentiles of the world too, will I dilute my effectiveness in... But I want to help her. And so he was silent. He was trying to figure this out. But the disciples grow impatient with the process and say, just do something. Just say something, Jesus. And so that's when he says to her, I've been sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. That tells us exactly what he's thinking in that moment. He's struggling with what he perceived as his limited focus, but his desire to help. That's when the woman falls on her knees, looks him in the eye, speaks right to his heart. Lord, my paraphrase, I don't care what your mission is. Help me. Help my daughter. And we know the heart of Jesus. Now he's really struggling. And he speaks those edgy, provocative words about it's not right to take the children's food and feed it to the dogs. Where did that come from? It came from the culture that Jesus had cut his teeth in. In first century Jewish culture, Pearson reminds us, it was common in Jesus' culture to refer to Gentiles that way. Jesus had probably heard that a million times because to first century Jews, Gentiles were like, spiritually speaking, were like wild, untamed animals. Like we would think of wolves. Dogs in first century Jewish culture were never household pets, Pearson tells us. They were feral. They were wild dogs. Wolf-like, they were aggressive scavengers. No person in their right mind would take food meant for their children and throw it to the wolves, i.e., the dogs. And so Jesus is reiterating in a way that he had heard often spoken in his own culture, he was reiterating the limited scope of his mission in a provocative way. But in a way that he'd heard so much, he might not have even realized how insensitive that could sound to someone. But instead of giving up, the woman comes back at him with a thoughtful and clever response. "Yes, Lord, but even the dogs get to eat the table scraps." Because, Pearson reminds us, in Gentile culture, dogs were often household pets. Lived in the house, became a beloved part of the family, and as such were entitled to eat of the food made for the children. Leftovers, the table scraps. And so what this woman is really saying to Jesus in the cultural context in which he's speaking, she is pleading with him to see her not as an untamed spiritual wild thing, but as part of his family, as one of his, a person of faith. "Look at me, Lord. I have so much faith in you and what you can do that I believe a single table scrap will heal my daughter." And boom, it's as if Jesus has an epiphany. This untamed spiritual animal, this woman, has as great, if not greater, faith than anything he had seen in Israel. And that breaks through. Jesus grants her the miracle at that point. "Woman," he says, "great is your faith. May it be done to you according to your faith." And her daughter is healed. To me, that makes so much sense. That fits the facts of what's happening here. It may make us uncomfortable to think that Jesus himself had to go through a process of learning and growing, but that is the human experience, is it not? And if Jesus was authentically human, he had to go through a learning and growing process. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, it's innate to us, right? We all go through it. There was a family that had lived their entire time in a farmhouse way out in the sticks, far away from others. But then they moved to the big city, moved into a townhome. They arrived on a Friday evening late at night with their moving truck, went to bed, got up early the next morning, 6 a.m. Saturday morning, to unpack the boxes. And so mom and dad said to their 5-year-old boy, "We're going to unpack boxes. While we're doing that, go out in the yard and play." 20 minutes later, their little boy comes rushing back into the house, breathless and excited, and he says, "Mommy, Mommy, guess what? Every house in this neighborhood has a doorbell, and they all work." "What? Please tell me you didn't do that." This little boy had never been culturally exposed to doorbells, and so he didn't know doorbell etiquette. What he did innocently. But now here was his mom saying, "No, do not do that." And now he had a chance to learn and grow or to obstinately refuse. Not knowing isn't a sin, but not growing is. There are all things that we don't know. That's not a sin. What's a sin is when God gives us an opportunity to learn and grow, but we refuse to do it. There's nothing Jesus does in our gospel story that's a sin, that's morally wrong. He was learning and growing and being challenged by this woman that God had sent to him. And he listened, he learned, and he grew. And that is beautiful. That doesn't make me love Jesus any less. It only makes me love and respect him more and causes me even more to want to learn from him, because that means where I now walk, Jesus has also authentically walked, and he has the credibility now to show me the way, the truth, and the life. So, if that's what's happening in today's story, what are we supposed to learn from it? For starters, it seems to me we learn the critical importance that we, like Jesus before us, be lifelong learners. That we not dwell in the museum of everything, that we dwell in the museum of everything else, that we be open to the new, surprising, unexpected things that God might want to say to us in our life. Are you living with that openness? When God sends you the modern equivalent of this Gentile woman to teach you something new, are you going to be open to that or stuck in place? You're familiar with the name Fred Phelps. You know of whom I speak? The now deceased former leader of Westboro Baptist Church, that group that is infamous for its intolerance, its narrow-mindedness, how they view anybody that is different as someone to be condemned and hated. So they hate gay people, they hate Jewish people, they hate Muslims, they hate women who engage in, quote, non-traditional occupations. The list goes on. They even protest at the funerals of fallen United States soldiers. By the way, on this Memorial Day weekend, how many folks here have been active duty military, are or have been? Raise your hand. Thank you. Thank you for your service. Imagine protesting at the funeral of a fallen soldier because the Westboro Baptist Church says the reason God allowed that soldier to be killed was to punish America for its cultural inclusivity. Oh my. Megan Roper Phelps is a granddaughter of Fred Phelps. She was raised in that cloistered Westboro Baptist Church culture. It's all she ever knew. Her mother, Shirley Phelps, is a daughter of Fred Phelps. Shirley Phelps is a lawyer and became chief spokeswoman for Westboro Baptist Church. I once had an encounter with Shirley. It was way back when our church was doing the first citywide billboard campaign, Would Jesus Discriminate? And we were challenging people to see the scriptures differently on the subject of LGBTQ people. That billboard campaign actually made national news. Even the Washington Post wrote a story on it, and that caught the attention of Westboro Baptist Church and drew a bullseye around us, and they started denouncing us, this church, and what we were saying. And so a radio show wanted to do an interview with Shirley and with me to present both sides of the issue. So the host began by interviewing Shirley. We were in separate locations calling into the interview on phone. Interviewed Shirley first, and ooh, she was virulent. She was slinging it. Man, she was, you know, we were Satan incarnate. At one point, she said, that preacher, referring to me, he's just pulling it out of his backside. Her religious way of saying I was pulling it out of my ass, right? I mean, she was vituperative. He then comes to the conclusion of her part of the interview, and she goes offline, and he opens my mic and says, what did you think? And I chuckled and said, it takes your breath away, doesn't it? And he chuckled and said, yes, it does. And we went on to have a thoughtful, a civil conversation. Because I wanted to contrast the spirit of Jesus with the spirit of attacking and condemning. That was Megan Roper Phelps' mother and her grandfather. She cut her teeth in that culture and became one of them. In her 20s, she became their chief spokesperson on social media like Twitter. And she says, I had no trouble finding targets on Twitter. She said, I would go after them. One of those targets was a Jewish activist named David Abbott Bull. And she started going after him on Twitter, and he responded in kind. She puts it this way. She says, David's response to me was swift, cunning, and angry, exactly the response I expected and wanted, by the way. But soon after this initial foray, she said, something changed. He stopped speaking to her on Twitter and instead reached out to her behind the scenes for private one-on-one conversations, because he told her, I want to understand your experience, and I want to understand your thinking better. So he started just asking her all kinds of questions. Tell your story. Tell me why you think this. Tell me why. She then began to let down her guard and hear his story and ask him questions. And before long, they became friends. Then they came to a point in their relationship where he felt safe enough to ask her a very provocative question. He said, "Megan, you and I both know that there's a prominent person at Westboro Baptist Church that bore a child out of wedlock, but she's in leadership there, and you don't advocate that the Old Testament penalty of stoning to death should be applied to her. So why do you say gay people should be stoned to death?" They both knew who he was talking about. He was talking about her mother, Shirley Phelps, who bore a child out of wedlock. But she was the spokesperson for Westboro. What's with that? She's okay, but other... Megan says, "That question hit me like a thunderbolt. I suddenly had an epiphany. I suddenly began to realize the inconsistencies of what we were saying." And she said, "That opened the floodgate, and I started to ask myself all kinds of questions. And before long," she says, "I realized I can't be part of this anymore." So she left the Westboro Baptist Church. Her family has utterly renounced her and cut her off. And ironically, it's the people that she once condemned that have surrounded her with love and inclusion and have become her new family of choice. And now she travels around advocating, encouraging people who want to create positive change in this world to engage in the kind of civil, respectful, person-to-person conversations that David Abbott Bull engaged her with, because that's what made the difference for her. Megan puts it this way. She says, "It's been 5 years since I left Westboro and my family. And while the trauma and regret of that part of my life will always be with me, they're accompanied by a deep sense of hope. My life is forever changed by people who took the time to learn my story and share theirs with me. They forsook judgment and came to me with kindness and empathy. The impact was huge." She goes on to say, "I'm not trying to argue that every bigoted person can be converted to the side of acceptance and equality. What I am saying is there's a lot of hope for a lot of people who seem hopelessly lost, even people like me who were raised from birth to fear and condemn others." You see, what David Abbott Bull did for Megan Phelps in the story I just told you is exactly what the Gentile woman was doing for Jesus. I'm not comparing Jesus to Megan Phelps in her former state. What I'm saying is they both let God use them as instruments to help somebody else make a breakthrough and in insight and to grow. And they did that not by hating them, not by condemning them, not by calling them names, not by competing on social media for who can level the most bitter zinger, who can win the prize for saying the most snarky thing, which is what I see so many followers of Jesus in the world today doing. We come in here and we're all sweet and nice, and then we get online and we turn into that raging person behind the wheel in our vehicle, except we're on social media and we start saying nasty, mean things about people that we would hope to persuade. How is that going to persuade them? I always tell people, Jesus can still see what you're saying online. So speak online the way you would speak to somebody in person with Jesus standing around. You can say anything you need to say civilly and with grace, and we just might change somebody's heart and mind because of it. So, let's wrap it up. What do we learn from today's gospel story that we can apply in our lives today? Number one, it isn't a sin not to know, but it is a sin not to grow. Am I staying open to the new, unexpected things God might want to say to me? Number two, invective and anger is not the way to persuade people and create positive change. Model yourself after what the Gentile woman does in our story. Kindness coupled with thoughtful presentation of our points is what creates change. And then lastly, and I'll close with this, I do want to make clear, I agree with the lesson that is drawn from the traditional interpretation of the story. It's just that I get there by interpreting what happened in the story differently. I agree that we need to learn from this story, from the example of this Gentile woman, the power of relentlessly persistent faith. Am I applying that kind of faith to the obstacles I'm encountering in my life, to what needs to change in me, or what I hope to change in others. I'll close with this. Back in 1946, two sisters, Frieda Parks and Winifred Parks, were accepted as undergraduate students at Purdue University. But these two sisters were not permitted to live in residential dormitories on the Purdue campus because they were African American. And at the time, Purdue had a policy that prohibited African Americans from living on campus. In fact, at the time, the city of West Lafayette was a sundown town, which means that if you were African American, you had to be out of town before sundown or else. So they couldn't even live in West Lafayette. So they found the housing they could afford outside the city limits, didn't have a bath, didn't have a shower, had one desk to share between them, and had to take multiple buses to get to and from their classes every day. But like the woman in today's story, they were absolutely determined and persistent in their faith. They were going to get an equal education. And they weren't just going to get an equal education. They were determined to change the system that made it so hard for them to get an equal education. Historian John Norberg describes it this way: through a winning combination of dispassionate logic, not vituperative ad hominem attacks, but through a winning combination of dispassionate logic, strategic networking, and unflagging endurance, these two sisters engaged in a year-long campaign to reverse Purdue's discriminatory policy. They wrote letters. They visited dignitaries. They rallied support wherever they could get it. Eventually, they went to and found support from Indiana's then governor, Ralph Gates, whose pressure ultimately broke the stalemate so that in 1947, Winifred and Frieda Parks moved into the residential dormitories at Purdue University, the first African Americans to do so. They broke the barrier. How? Through unyielding faith, persistence, determination, and civilly making their case, appealing to the hearts and minds of those who were persuadable. We are called to do the same. By the way, 4 years ago, Purdue University named two of their residential dormitories, renamed them. One is now called the Frieda Parks Residential Dormitory, the other, the Winifred Parks Residential Dormitory. Honoring their courage, their faith, their persistence. Creating change is not for the faint of heart. It takes enormous patience and a spirit of relentless persistence. It ain't easy, but that is precisely the kind of faith that gets results ultimately. Embrace it, wield it, practice it like Frieda and Winifred and like the Gentile woman in Matthew chapter 15. I began this sermon by saying today's gospel passage is my least favorite. I think it's becoming one of my favorites now. Thank you, Jesus. Thank you for this great gospel story. We love you, Lord. Amen.